BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Our prisons are so overcrowded, the government recently released a group of prisoners early to ease the pressure. This was what Sir Humphrey and Yes Minister might call a brave decision. Britain seems to incarcerate more people per head of population than any other Western European country. Now the government has announced there's going to be a review of sentencing to see what we can do to reduce the number of people in prison. Very recently, an 8-week consultation period began, during which members of the public can send in their thoughts on how to tackle these issues. So let's try and contribute to the review by asking here, why are prisons so overcrowded and what can we do about it? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, some carefully curated key stats from the briefing room's Charlotte MacDonald.
As of March 2024, the UK had a total prison population of approximately 97,700 people. That's an increase of nearly 20% over the last 20 years. Since the Second World War, the prison population had been increasing, but from the mid-1990s, it started to grow more sharply until 2015. It flattened off. Then during the pandemic, it dipped. But since then, it started to rise again. The prison services are run separately in England and Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. As of March 2024, there were approximately 134 prisoners per 100,000 of the population in England and Wales, just slightly more in Scotland with 136 per 100,000 and lower in Northern Ireland with just 88 per 100,000. Looking at England and Wales in more detail, prison sentences have got longer. This means that the proportion of people given sentences of 4 years or more has been going up, while the proportion of those serving less than a year has been going down. Around a third of all those given sentences were for offences classed as violence against the person. Sexual offences was the second highest category for adults, at 1 in 5. Research from before the pandemic found that 70% of custodial sentences were imposed on those with at least 7 previous convictions or cautions, and half are imposed on those with at least 15 previous convictions or cautions. Around 4% of the prison population is female. As of May 2024, 60% of prisons in England and Wales were classified as crowded. Money. The 2020 Spending Review settlement provided the Ministry of Justice with £4 billion to expand prison capacity. This was intended to fund 20,000 new prison places by the mid-2020s, but that looks like that's not going to be achieved.
Charlotte MacDonald. That's the what, now the why. I'm joined by John Podmore, former prison governor and prison inspector, and author of Out of Sight, Out of Mind, Why Britain's Prisons Are Failing. And Nicola Padfield, Emeritus Professor of Criminal and Penal Justice at the University of Cambridge. John Podmore, why are our prisons overcrowded?
Well, for a number of reasons. Firstly, as a nation, we're addicted to prison. And you know, put out the stats that we incarcerate more than any other country in Western Europe per 100,000 of the population. I mean, the system at the moment is, it's like a bath, if you like, with the plug in, the taps turned on full, but with the overflow coming back in. So we're increasing the sentences. So things like burglary sentence rates have gone up by over 70%, you know, things like manslaughter over 100%. So, you know, what we haven't done over the years is flatten the curve of prison demand. And that demand has come, we have to say, from the public, but also from politicians. So it's a combination of those coming into the system, our obsession with custody, our belief that the answer's prison, what's the question, and that we can sort of change attitudes and behaviours and performance by using imprisonment. But also it's about those going out. It's about the overflow that's coming back into the bath. And there's some startling stats around recalls. That's people coming back into prison, not necessarily because they've reoffended, but because they're not surviving out in the community. The job of the prison service is to lock up people, to protect the public, but also to prepare them for release during that sentence. And then it's the job of the probation service to support them and support them in the community such that they don't come back. And that component is singularly failing. So something like 12,000 prisoners in at the moment have been out and come back. And then we have obviously reoffending rates. And if we want to get into that, reoffending rates at the moment are difficult to measure when so many offences like burglary and car crime have effectively been decriminalised.
Right. In other words, they're not solved and they're not followed up. Nicola, what would you add to that? I'm particularly interested in this recall problem because it's not something that I think the public knows much about. I think perhaps we should just tell people very quickly what recall actually is.
Well, everybody comes out of prison under supervision at the moment, whether you've gone in a very short sentence or you're a lifer, you will come out with license conditions and be supervised by the probation service. And some of them will be recalled because their electronic curfew stopped working. Maybe they tampered with it or something. People are recalled for all sorts of reasons, that they didn't sleep where they were meant to sleep, or the probation officer's worried that they've started drinking again. So in your period of supervision after release, many people are coming out, especially now, after 40% of the time in prison. So the period of supervision in the community is quite long. And recall is a process whereby the probation service can initiate recall to prison. People can be re-released by the prison service. They can have a fixed term recall, but many, many people come on what's called a standard recall, and they'll wait for a very, very long time until the parole board considers their case and decides to re-release them.
Right. John, you talked earlier about longer sentences. What crimes are currently attracting longer sentences than they used to?
Almost every offence that you can think of has an increased sentence length. And if we talk about mandatory life sentences for murder, where there is a tariff, a minimum that will be served for deterrence and retribution, those have gone up significantly, you know, almost doubled. I mean, when I joined the prison service way, way back in the 80s, you know, sentences of 20 years were seen as particularly heavy sentences. But now 35, 40 years is not seen as exceptional. I think someone yesterday was sentenced with a minimum of 38 years.
Essentially, this is incremental. Bit by bit, over the last 20 or odd years, the sentences have just gone up for all these things, and successive governments have put them up. Nicola?
I would go back a lot longer than that. I mean, I started teaching in 1990, and that was when we were all trying to say loudly that 40,000 was too many people. And so it's been going up very steadily since at least 1990. The rise isn't just the last 20 years.
Let's talk about prisons themselves. Nicola, do we have enough prisons and prison places?
It depends how many prisoners you have. Clearly, we don't at the moment. There's terrible overcrowding. But I would argue that the solution was to reduce the number of people in prison rather than to build more prisons. The likelihood of building ourselves out of the problem seems to be an unhelpful solution, not least because of the cost of prisons. It's a fantastically expensive way of housing people. And so I think the answer, as far as I'm concerned, has to be to work out who shouldn't be in prison or who has been sent to prison for too long under current systems, and see if we can find mechanisms to reduce the prison population. But another problem is too few staff, and many of those staff are very inexperienced staff. So I think just a bed count isn't the solution. We've got to look at the whole system.
John, what has happened to the resources for the other things in prisons that a good prison would need over the last 20 or so years?
Well, it's all predicated on leadership and management and culture and staffing. You know, you need to have education, training. But Charlie Taylor, who is a brilliant chief inspector of prison, he's regularly reporting on these facilities are there but unused. There are empty classrooms, empty workshops. Now, we have to ask why. And Nicola's referred to this this loss of experience. And I would go further. Not only have we lost that experience, we have issues in terms of the experience and culture of managers. But it's not just what's on in prison. I've worked a lot with charitable organizations who are knocking on the doors of prisons saying, you know, we can offer this, we can provide accommodation on release, we can provide training, but the culture of the prison service is, it's so insular, it doesn't accept that kind of help. But we have a staffing crisis in prison, and that has to be dealt with first and foremost before we can begin to deliver constructive regimes that are going to get prisoners out such that they don't come back.
Just very quickly, before we come on to probation, why do we have a staffing crisis?
Well, there was a cost-saving exercise about 10 years ago. The prison service was told to save some money, so it came up with the easiest, quickest solution, which was to get rid of the oldest, most experienced staff. And it didn't think that through. It blames government, but the methodology was the prison services. So a lot of staff were let go. The actual ratios dropped considerably, but also did the experience levels. Now, government and the prison service realised they caught a bit of a cold there, and they have been trying to recruit. But in that effort to recruit, they've lost out in terms of vetting. Training is only 6 or 7 weeks, whereas, you know, and I've worked across the world, and it's the shortest and probably the most inadequate training level that I've seen anywhere. You go to Scandinavia, I mean, I've worked out in South America and it's 2 years.
John Podmore and Nicola Padfield will be back later. But before they return, how do we compare internationally? Catherine Hurd is director of the World Prison Research Programme. Catherine Hurd, we heard at the top of the programme that we're sending more people to prison than in Western Europe. Why do other Western European countries just seem to jail fewer people than the UK does?
I think it's important to look at the length of time that people are going to prison for. It may be that we are simply completely different from those other European countries because we've seen a steady lengthening of prison terms over time. It's not happened because crimes here are somehow more serious or criminals here are more dangerous. It's about proportionality of response and it's about resort. So how quickly do you see a resort to custody? Where does the threshold lie in terms of alternatives? In the Netherlands, before someone proceeds to even to a court hearing, there's a sort of triage system that goes on where a full sort of panoply of experts, social services, it could be housing experts, substance abuse people if they're needed. They, you know, it could be youth services if the person is a fairly young individual, that they will all come together and feed into the decisions that are taken about whether to even charge the person or whether they should be diverted into some kind of other type of process altogether away from criminal justice. We are recalling to prison record numbers of people. That's another thing that makes us very different from European countries.
How do we compare to other similar countries outside the EU?
We could look at countries like Australia, New Zealand, for example, and our prison population rate, i.e. the number per 100,000 people we send to prison, is a little bit less. So New Zealand are sending currently 185 people to prison per 100,000, compared with England and Wales, 139. Australia also is higher than us. In fact, Australia is at the highest it's ever been right now at 162 per 100,000. Canada is a lot less. It's managed to drive its prison population rate down a lot since a peak in 1995. And it's currently at 90 per 100,000, so significantly less than us.
Let's go to the other big comparison, which is always made, which is with the United States. Firstly, how do we compare with the United States in terms of imprisoning people?
The United States is the global outlier still, even though it's fallen from its peak in terms of numbers per 100,000 in prison. That peaked at a staggering 2.3 million people in prison in 2008, which was well above 750-odd people per 100,000. Today, they've driven it right down to 541, but I say right down, but remember, we're at 139 and we're the European outliers. So yes, they are the global number one incarcerator. Probably if we had all the data for China, that country would have a larger prison population rate, but China doesn't publish information on its pre-trial prison population, whereas America does. In terms of prison overcrowding, America as an entire country, according to present data, doesn't actually fall into overcrowding. It's at 95% of capacity compared to England and Wales, 109%, Scotland, 100%. And there are many other European countries that are well over 100%. So France right now has 128% occupancy. That's severe overcrowding, and they're right to be concerned about that.
Does some of this come down to how different crimes are treated in different countries?
Well, certainly we've done some comparative studies ourselves on the way the same offence would be sentenced in a diverse group of 10 countries globally. We, for example, looked at an offence where a woman aged 26 was arrested for bringing into the UK or whichever country she's arrested in 400 grams of a Class A drug. Now, what's fascinating is that in the Netherlands, that person, age 26 when sentenced, would still be 26 when she was released, because even if she was unlucky, she wouldn't be serving more than 5 or 6 months in prison. In England and Wales, the likely release date would probably be at age 28. In Hungary, she'd be closer to 30. In the USA, in New York State, which was where we analyzed the law, she'd be closer to 31. Same in Australia and similar in Brazil. But right up at the other end of the scale, in India, she'd be age 46. And in Thailand, most likely she would spend her entire natural life in prison.
Catherine Hurd. So, what should the UK be doing to tackle the prisons crisis? Back with me are Nicola Padfield and John Podmore. John Podmore first. This isn't the first time we've discussed prisons on this programme. The crisis has been known about for many years. So why has it not been solved, or why have no significant progress been made to solve it?
Well, there's been no political will, and there's been no attempt really to change the culture of the prison service, which harps back to the 60s, where it's about security, security, security. And we need to actually be looking more carefully about the different types of prisoner we lock up, how we deal with them, and how we deal with the prison estate. And I think we need a major rethink on the prison system.
I suppose what I was getting at, John, was before we come on to the kind of ways in which we could solve the problem, is what were the impediments in government's way in solving the problem up until now?
Well, I think political fear, institutional temerity, but also a failure to think laterally about what the problems are. And we know what works in prison. We know it's a job, a home, and a stable relationship, just like all of us. You know, if we have those three components in our lives, then we're more likely to lead a positive and a fruitful life. But the prison system is not able to do that. But, you know, we need to think who we're locking up, and we should be locking up people we're afraid of, not who we're mad at. And if we look at the prison population, we've got something around 50-60% of prisons are in for non-violent offences. So what I would advocate is actually splitting up the prison and probation service and put the probation service back into local areas. But you know, I would take that chunk of the prison service that is dealing with short sentence, relatively non-violent people coming in and out, revolving doors, and I would turn that into a community prison estate, and I would devolve that to the Metro Mayors. The Metro Mayors have certain powers, and they have powers over housing, education, skills, employment, health and social care. And those are all the things that short-term prisoners serving for non-violent offences, having approved premises, having resettlement facilities, reintegration facilities, bail hostels. It's about having a structure at that end of the spectrum. And I think that would be more productive, would cost less. And the very dangerous people, of whom there are many in prison, you know, we could have, for want of a better phrase, you know, a federal estate where security and containment is much more the focus.
Nicola, I'm about to say from the discussion so far that one thing that really stands out is a complete lack of joined up thinking and joined up approach, and that actually what you and John are saying is you need to build in that joined up approach. It sometimes feels that the British way of doing things is that each bit takes its decision, washes its hand then of the person involved, and hands them on to the next section of who they've got to deal with.
You can certainly say that in relation to the whole criminal justice process. You start with the police response to crime, the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service's decision to prosecute somebody for crime X rather than crime Y has a huge impact on sentencing, because, of course, if they go for a more serious offence, there will be a longer sentence attached to that when the judge comes to sentencing. So I think having a whole process approach would be useful, and that's not limited just to worrying about whether prison and probation and health services talk to each other enough.
John, as for my entire journalistic life, one of the things that's been talked about has been the question of whether prisons and the system overall can prevent reoffending and recidivism. What are we going to do to try and tackle that? What should we do?
Well, I've talked about restructuring the whole service, and essential to that is involving communities more. And I think, certainly my experience at Brixton, I've recently met with a community organisation that's looking to help and support an improved Wandsworth. Communities care, because who's in prison? Well, it's members of the community, and they're passing through, and sometimes they're passing through for a very short space of time. And, you know, I lived and worked in Brixton, and the local community were passionate about what was going on in the prison, because it was their community members going in, and their families and their friends and their brothers and their sisters and so on and so forth, you know, which is why I'm very much into the concept of community prisons. It would be run more like a school, you know, with a local board that appoints the governor, that's asking questions about not only what's going on in the prison, but what's going on in the community to prevent people coming into prison. And if they go into prison, what's in the community to stop them coming back in? So I think at that level, we could do a lot more, and it would be a lot more cost effective than building £4 billion worth of new warehouses.
So, Nicola, if we want to reduce numbers in prison, are we going to have to accept that some people with very long criminal records are going to get released much earlier?
Well, I think we can think at the beginning or the end. So the label persistent offenders, very, very often persistent offenders are serial shoplifters or consistently burglars. Just longer sentences is clearly not the solution, because otherwise they wouldn't be doing it again if the previous sentence had worked. So I think it's sort of obvious that just lengthening the sentence doesn't solve that problem. We have to be much more creative in looking at why this person is a persistent offender. When you come to much, much more serious crimes, many problems are attached, I think, to how we assess risk. We talked earlier about the parole board, and it's cautious. John called it risk-averse. Well, its instructions are to be risk-averse. It works on the basis of trying to predict risk, and trying to predict rare events is a really, really difficult business. In many countries, they are much more supportive of offenders when they are released. We are much, much more cautious. And I think what we've got to do now is be quite imaginative in thinking about whether there are better ways of supporting people in the community than the way we do it at the moment.
John, I'm wondering if you agree with that. I mean, and just to put, if you like, the point that many listeners might feel, which is, look, you've got this person running around reoffending. Surely the way to deal with that is to give them longer and longer sentences.
Well, that's fine and dandy if they never, ever come out. And we've only currently got about 70 people in prison serving whole life sentences. You know, we need to understand that unless we're going to sentence everybody to indefinite detention, they're coming out. But we need to give some thought to phrases that seem to have lapsed, which is sentence planning and sentence management. And the object of a sentence is obviously to protect the public. But in terms of what goes on during that sentence, you know, we need to sort of wake up and smell the coffee here, is that prison is actually making people worse at the moment. And Charlie Taylor, Chief Inspector, has outlined cases where, you know, young men have gone in without an addiction and come out with both a drug addiction and significant debt in maintaining that. But what we need to be doing, and I'm a great believer in flexibility of sentences, you know, as a governor, you know, managing someone who's never going to get out is very difficult. And if there's flexibility in sentences, so if someone does get a degree, someone does work to gain the qualifications for an apprenticeship, if someone does properly kick their drug habit, and we've worked constructively with them throughout their sentence to maintain that, then maybe we can let them out early, but we can do so. So saying to the public, look, you know, we have had a positive, a constructive prison system, it's decent, humane, protecting the public and reducing the prison population, because that's what will happen if you properly manage sentences.
Our time's up, so my thanks to John Podmore, Nicola Padfield and Catherine Hurd. And my conclusion, the problem, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. We as citizens need to change our attitudes towards imprisonment, otherwise there's little incentive for governments to change. And related to all this, starting next Tuesday morning is a new series of the Reef Lectures with the forensic psychiatrist Dr. Gwen Adshead. She's spent nearly 40 years talking to perpetrators of violence inside prisons and in some of our best-known psychiatric institutions like Broadmoor, trying to find out why some are driven to violence and asking how best can we manage that violence. As for us, we'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Beth Ashmead-Latham, Kirsty Knight and Charlotte MacDonald. The sound engineers were Rod Farker and Never Masurian. And the editor is Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.